Now, while Dennis Wheeler's trying to make a map of the Earth's climate in the 17th and 18th centuries, NASA's building a map of the solar system. It's called the All-Sky Map. And this week, the space agency announced a discovery that could shed light on an area at the outer edge of our solar system. It's a border region that protects us from cosmic rays. Richard Fisher is the director of the Heliophysics Division at NASA, and he's here in the studio with me. Welcome.
Well, thanks.
Some exciting news out of NASA this week. The All-Sky Map was unveiled. What is it?
Well, the All-Sky Map is the output of something called the Interstellar Boundary Explorer mission. And this is an experiment that was designed to make a picture of the boundary between our galaxy and our solar system. And the reason there is such a thing is, if you can imagine the circumstance, where we have a solar wind. And what that means is it's a wind off our star. And if you wanted to try and visualize this, think about standing here on Earth and you had a wind that blew straight up off the planet. And the sun blows a great big bubble around our solar system, and it's a protective bubble. It convects magnetic field out to the edge of this, and it produces a magnetic shield around our solar system.
And that shield is the heliosphere.
That shield is the heliosphere.
And it protects us from?
From cosmic radiation, from the galaxy. And it absorbs about 68-75% of all the galactic cosmic radiation. And we're shielded from the rest of it by the Earth's magnetic field. So we're on Earth, we're pretty safe from this stuff.
So in 2008, NASA launched the IBEX, the Interstellar Boundary Explorer, the spacecraft that takes photographs way out. What did it capture?
Well, it captures an image that looks like what it would be if you were inside of a bubble, if you can imagine such a thing. And you would have to look around. You'd have to turn your head every direction in order to see all the features. And so we have a way of plotting this on a single map. And it's kind of an oval map. It's a projection. And what it shows is that there is a stripe across the inside of this bubble. The question is, what is that stripe? It's completely unexpected. What I had anticipated, and I'm kind of a traditional physicist, what I'd expected would be that we'd see it bright on one side and dark on the other because material was piling up on the side that's plowing through the galaxy. And that is visualized to a certain extent. But this other feature has another characteristic which is very curious, which is it is aligned, it's perpendicular to what we think is the direction of the magnetic field of the galaxy.
Well, what does it tell us about our place in the galaxy?
Well, I think that what it tells us is that, first of all, there's a little bit of come down to Earth and be a little bit humble, because all of a sudden expectation doesn't fit preconceived theory.
But what was the expectation?
And the expectation was that it would be a teardrop-shaped structure, sort of a bubble plowing into the galactic wind on one side and trailing off sort of like a teardrop on the other side.
Is this the farthest out we've ever seen?
Oh, no. We see much further out than this, but it's the first time we've seen this structure. There's been no way to visualize it previously. It isn't actually light. It's we're detecting particles that come from that region. So it's as if you had a bank of cloud that was emitting some kind of particle, like a raindrop. Only in this case, it's emitting neutral hydrogen. And so the neutral hydrogen detectors make this image for us.
So we don't actually know what this stripe does?
Well, we know it's made out of hydrogen, out of protons that recombine with electrons. We don't know the process by which it is draped over the heliosphere. And we also don't understand exactly why it has brighter spots in it. It's not just a uniform kind of stripe. It's got intensity and density in it. And what in the world makes that? It's going to be fascinating to see.
Where do you go from here? I mean, how can you continue, or how will you continue to study this stripe in the heliosphere?
If there are changes in it, we certainly know that the changes can come from either changes in the galactic wind blowing on us or changes in the solar wind that blows this bubble. And we can follow the solar wind pretty well. And we'll straighten out causality. What are these changes and why are they there? I think the second thing is that it just says in previous models, we're not using the right physics. And the physicists are going to have to go back and consider what physical processes may be left out of these calculations and My guess is that within a couple of years, we'll have a pretty good explanation of this.
Richard Fisher is the director of the Heliophysics Division at NASA. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much. A great pleasure to be here.
There are places in our lives that now are only memories. Over the past few months, we've asked you to tell us about some of the places that were important to you but no longer exist. San Antonio, Texas is famous for the Alamo, but you may not have heard about another city landmark. In today's installment of our series, Place and Memory, producer Shay Shackelford went to Texas to find Taco Land.
If you follow the San Antonio River north, past the Alamo, into an industrial area that once housed the old Pearl Brewery, you'll come to a cinder block building with an ancient live oak. The building's vacant now, but this was once the loudly beating heart of San Antonio's underground music scene. This was Taco Land.
There's a place in San Antonio where I can go. Now I feel alone!
Taco Land, it's a fantasy.
Long before the Dead Milkmen ever wrote this song about it, Taco Land was just an after-work beer joint. Shift workers from the Pearl Brewery and folks from the neighborhood were shooting pool and drinking cheap, cold beer. But around 1980, a young cowpunk band called the Hickoids play what many believe was the first underground punk show at Taco Land.
What's the matter, little feller? Ain't you never seen a cross-dresser before?
Part of the punk ideal was finding authenticity, and this place was unpolished enough and foreign enough to these kids to fit that bill. Not to mention, it was full of cold beer.
Well, he's queen of the barbecue. He looks much better dressed than you. Well.
The Hickoids weren't the only ones who found something new that night. Taco Land's owner was Ramiro Ayala, or Ram, as everybody called him. And after running that bar for 15 years, he connected with something about the freedom those kids were trying to find, and their recklessness. He opened the door to anyone who wanted to play.
Taco Land. What? ¿Qué pasó, Derry? Hey, dude, you're for the 23rd.
Taco Land quickly became a sanctuary for all the bands in San Antonio that didn't fit in anywhere else, and Ram became their patron saint.
Oh, hey, I'm Belle Sayoa, and I was a longtime customer, friend, and music lover over at Taco Land. He allowed that music to be here, which was more underground, punk, you know, surfer or rockabilly, everything that most of the clubs wouldn't allow.
Ram's original customers didn't necessarily see it the same way when these kids and their band started coming in, dressing weird and playing really, really loud music. Jeff Smith is with the Hickoids.
They say, well, what the hell are you doing bringing these bands in here? And he goes, hey man, they're here to rock and roll, and if you don't like it, you can go sit outside or you can go somewhere else.
Some regulars left, some stayed, and the bands kept coming. Ram treated everyone the same, which meant occasionally yelling and kicking you out if you didn't follow Taco Land's golden rule. Basically, don't be mean to anybody and have a great time.
I want to meet you in the morning at my favorite taco stand. I get some migas, huevos rancheros. I want to be your San Antonio man.
Taco Land became one of those bars where people who would never otherwise know each other became friends. Phil Luna was in a band whose name I can't say here, but let's call them the Poop City Dream Girls.
If you wanted to hear the band, you open the front door, you're immediately being pushed out by the crowd on the inside.
Two, three, cuatro.
You'd fight your way to the bar, and you just didn't care. You knew everybody that you rubbed into, so it was just a hug to the right and a hug to the left and a butt smack and a kiss and a take a shot of this. And I don't remember the paneling or the posters. I remember nakedness and then seeing things very close up in a very blurry way, you know.
Half of going to Taco Land was going to see Ram. He had tons of sayings, and everyone there latched onto them. Like when bands were playing, he'd yell,
"One more time for the March of Dimes!" Ram was definitely a cool cat.
Santiago Garcia is a San Antonio poet.
He seemed to me a little bit Pachuco-inspired. He had the hint of a slick-backed hairdo. He wore dark shades at all times. He had this little mustache. He was an iconic man.
Ram's favorite expression can't be repeated on the radio.
I think the nice way you can say that is, "Turn it up, wussy." I think he was just telling you to take it to another level. He was a very funny guy, and I think he was just picking on you, trying to hit the chip on your shoulder or make you loosen up. If you went in there and you took that as a criticism, you didn't get it.
Ram said it best at a 1996 documentary about Taco Land.
They really taught us that you play, we drink together, you know. We might not make no money, but hey, man, we have a good time. You can buy a good time. I don't care where you just can buy it. I mean, the good time is here.
All right, here we go.
Taco Land gained an underground notoriety. National acts like Yola Tango and the Minutemen would book shows there. But the heart of Taco Land was always local music and a family of loyal customers. There were a series of people who formally and informally worked there over the years, who Ram had taken under his wing. Denise Kogert was one of those folks. She worked for Ram for 5 years. She was there the night that everything ended at Taco Land. She was coming from the back when she saw two guys talking with Ram at the bar.
I heard Ram's last words. I don't know if I can say those or not right now. You know, F you. And then, boom, the guy shot him.
The two men robbed the bar, shooting Denise and another coworker before they left.
You know, the jukebox is blaring, playing, like, Mexican music real loud. There's the smell of gunfire in. There's blood everywhere, money all over the floor. And then I kind of dragged myself around to Ram, and he was laying there. He looked perfectly handsome. He wasn't moving, but his sunglasses were askew. And I put them back on his face for him. I've seen a lot of things in my life, and I've known a lot of different type of people. But never in my wildest dreams could I see anyone hurting a person like Ram.
Ram Ayala died that night. He was 72, and he'd been running Taco Land for 40 years. After the shooting, Taco Land never reopened. It's been 4 years, and the building is still there, like a shrine or a ruins. Eric Sandin from the band Buttercup still goes by every so often.
It's weird because in the heyday, it was much bigger than it is now. It's shrunk since. I don't know if this happens to other spaces, but especially you've got like such a strong personality like Ram. And then that soul leaves. It just leaves a big space.
Taco Land was a movie. It had a beginning and it had an end. It had a soundtrack and it had a crazy storyline that went in and out of everybody's lives. I'm not sure it really happened. No. I wish there was a piece that I could share with my kids or I could share with future bandmates. No way, man.
There's a place, San Antonio, where I can go. Nah, be alone!
We heard from Phil Luna, Bell Soyoa, Jeff Smith, Santiago Garcia, Eric Sandin, Denise Koger, and several San Antonio bands. Archival tape of Ramiro Ayala was provided by Laura Escamilla Forat. Since we announced this series, many of our listeners have shared hundreds of memories at placeandmemory.org. Take a minute to visit and share your own stories. Place and Memory is produced by Shay Shackelford and Jennifer Deer of Big Shed Audio. It's part of Maker's Quest, a project of AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. To learn more, go to npr.org/quest. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In Finland, the static noise of a dial-up modem and the stress of a slow web connection soon will be relics of the past. Beginning next July, every person in the country of Finland will have the legal right to a 1 megabyte internet connection. It's the first country in the world to make broadband internet access a legal requirement. Suvi Linden is Finland's Minister of Communications, and she's on the phone from Finland. First of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why does your government consider broadband internet access to be a legal right?
We are pushing forward very strongly the development of information society. We decided that broadband connections are no longer this kind of luxury product and just for entertainment. But I think in a short time, there will be more and more e-services like net banking and stuff like that for citizens to use, and therefore we really need to have access and possibility to use e-services.
Will citizens have to pay money out of their own pockets?
Yeah, they pay for the monthly payment for the connection.
What happens if a citizen can't afford this?
At this moment, the broadband connection, the prices are fairly low. Still, this is an option. It's not compulsory for anyone to have a connection.
There's a little over 5 million people in the country, and the new law requires telecom companies to start providing this high-speed internet services across the country. How has the private sector in Finland responded to this new law?
It's a common project because teleoperators know that since we get the better infrastructure, it's a good possibility for them also provide new e-services. And I think that in the long term, they will profit on this decision, even though, of course, they weren't very happy about it. But we have also a goal for 2015. We want to provide 100 megabyte. But we start with 1 megabyte, and by the end of 2010, 99% of the population is covered by wireless connection.
Suvi Linden is the Minister of Communications in Finland, and she joined us by phone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. Seven years ago, a pianist named Guy Livingston came into NPR's Studio 4A and performed for host Lynn Neary. But he didn't play for long. Each piece was around 60 seconds. For his CD, Don't Panic, 60 Seconds for Piano, he commissioned dozens of composers to write tiny vignettes. One composer even notated a 21-second prance across the keys by his cat. Guy Livingston has now taken the idea one step into the multimedia age. He commissioned 5 Dutch filmmakers to add a visual dimension. The result is a new DVD, 1 minute more, 60 films, 60 composers, 60 seconds each. Guy Livingston, who makes his home in Paris, is now on a North American tour, and he joins us now from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome back to the program, Guy.
Thank you very much, Leah. Thanks for that great intro.
Well, you know, I went back to 2002 when you spoke to Lynn Neary and heard that you told her that composers were intrigued by the constraints of writing in a 60-second frame. And you quoted Stravinsky, who said that great art likes chains. What about filmmakers? Were they intrigued by the constraints of filming in a 60-second frame?
Absolutely. But what is the funny paradox here is that the filmmakers were much more used to that. If you've ever filmed a commercial or even thought about filming one, 30 seconds might be a good length. So for the filmmakers, in a way, the conceptual leap was easier to take.
Thank you. Do the compositions, you think, say something about the perception of time?
Totally. The music is being forced into an unreasonable constraint, and then that makes everybody think about time in a different way and try to mark the passing of time in different ways. Mm. And some of it moves forward very, very, very hard, very, very quickly, and with a huge high velocity, and other stuff moves in an extremely slow manner. And yet, the slow piece might seem much shorter.
Mm. All 32 Beethoven sonatas.
That is definitely an ultimate compression. He's taken one bar from each of the 32 Beethoven sonatas and strung them together in a way that actually makes sense.
Tell us who some of the filmmakers are.
We have, like you said, we have five filmmakers. They're all Dutch. Thijs Schroeder, Nelleke Koop, Knut Hinton, Menno Otten, and Juan de Graaf. And they all made films, some of which are abstract, some of which are more narrative. And with the exception of Juan de Graaf, who made animations in which the pianist character sort of comes to life and has these series of 10 adventures with the piano.
They're interesting adventures. There's one piece that I love called The Angel, and there's this kind of animated character with a really big nose, and he's interacting with this animated piano, and the snow is coming down. And toward the end of the film, the piano's top opens up and protects the animated character from the snow.
Gives him shelter.
Yeah. Were there images that surprised you?
Totally. I'll give you an example. One of the ones that really astounded me was by Menno Otten, and it's a piece by the composer David Dram. It's called Ruby. What is Ruby? Ruby is the affectionate name for a metronome that has a little ruby LED on it that blinks on and off in time with the music that you're playing when you're practicing. And so if you use this metronome, the light blinks on and off while it goes click, 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 click. But David, the composer, discovered that if you cover the metronome with your fingers while you're letting it play, it's click, 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 that you can make different sounds with it. So you can make loud clicks and soft clicks. And so he wrote a piece where I'm holding the metronome in one hand, making it go click, 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 by moving my hand across it. And at the same time, with the other hand, I'm playing the piano.
Yeah.
And that by itself was kind of an odd piece. But when you put it together with the images, which are of a train line, it's actually shot from the window of a train turned sideways in such a manner that it's totally abstract until the end. You don't realize what it is. It's quite beautiful, and it gets that same thing, that clickety, 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 that you would have on a train. And that's a case where the filmmaker completely surprised me, and also the composer, and took the piece to an entirely different level.
Here's one I really liked. I found the images to be mesmerizing. It was Thijs Schroeder's film, mm-hmm. and it was Last Minute Tango. And it's a tango that you're playing on the piano, but the image are these construction cranes that are filmed and overlapped and in such a way that they really are dancing with one another.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Well, it's always wonderful when I do that in... That's a piece by Frank J. O'Terry, the composer. And when I do the piece in concert with the film, the audience always, they're sort of like, at the last moment when the two cranes come together, it's like they're kissing or something. They just suddenly touch, and these two huge, gigantic, abstract pieces of construction material suddenly seem, you know, like they're lovers.
Yeah.
It's quite a beautiful moment.
So So how did you pay these guys? Last time you paid your composers in, I believe, a bottle of Jack Daniels.
This is true. This is true. We paid composers this time with a watch, a special watch made by Stamps, which is a Berlin company that does kind of high-level design, nifty things. And each watch design is different. There are different designs, and each one is based on one of the films.
Wow.
And they're quite funky.
Okay, yeah. So go ahead.
I should respond. Maybe I should say something serious about that before it sounds too frivolous.
Sure.
The royalties actually from the disc are, because of the complexity of handling royalties for 60 composers on one disc, the royalties are donated to Doctors Without Borders.
Oh.
So it's not completely frivolous.
Pianist Guy Livingston, his new DVD project is called 1 Minute More, 60 films, 60 composers, 60 seconds each. He's currently on tour and plays in Chicago tomorrow night and will be coming soon to Montreal, New York, and Washington, D.C. Guy joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Guy, thanks very much. Good luck with this.
Thank you so much, Leon. It's been a pleasure.
You can watch films from Guy Livingston's 1 Minute More on our website, nprmusic.org. Another Colorado story caught our attention this past week. Voters in the state elected to legalize medical marijuana almost a decade ago. But this year, there's been a boom in the number of dispensaries. Now the Denver alternative weekly newspaper Westword is seeking a freelance pot critic. The actual job title is Medical Marijuana Dispensary Reviewer. Patricia Calhoun is editor of the Westword, and she joins us from member station KCFR in Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
The basic requirements for this job, the applicants must have a medical marijuana card from their doctor, and they have to submit an essay on what marijuana means to me. I'm interested, what kind of essays are you getting? What are people saying?
We are getting quite the range of essays. We've gotten probably 300 of them, some who have these unbelievable, heartbreaking stories about the pain they have in their body from some ailment that has only been cured by medical marijuana. And some are just true pot fans, and this is their dream job.
Have you received any negative feedback at all?
We have. We've had threats of boycotts from people who are true marijuana lovers who think this is a cynical move. Actually, it's a pretty sincere one, because with the boom in medical marijuana dispensaries, you have every kind possible, and it's actually going to be useful for people to know what the ambiance is like, what the products are like, what they can expect when they go in there.
Let me ask you, for the person who gets the job, do you have any concerns at all about this person, like, meeting deadlines, losing their train of thought, I mean, you know, punctuation, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, we don't drug test our employees as it is, and it's not unlikely that we have several people on staff who would already have great qualifications for this job, but they all managed to make their deadline, so I think we'll be able to build it in.
So the picture you have in your mind of your ideal applicant, your ideal critic, what would that be?
Ideally, it would be like any critic. It would be someone who is a very entertaining writer, has very good opinions, and is able to arrive at those opinions through actual reporting and analysis. Now, will what the person is reviewing affect their ability to be analytical? We'll see.
Patricia Calhoun is editor of Westword, an alternative weekly newspaper in Denver. The paper is looking for a medical marijuana critic. Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
In early December, delegates from around the world will sit down to talk climate change at a major UN-sponsored conference in Copenhagen. There will, no doubt, be political wrangling over how to reduce carbon emissions, but away from the politics is the work of climatologists, the people who come up with the models that predict how climate change will unfold. Dennis Wheeler from the University of Sunderland in Britain is one of those climatologists, but he's not only looking at the latest cutting-edge data to map the future of weather. He's reaching back hundreds of years to the logbooks kept by sailors during those early, harrowing naval voyages in the Age of Discovery.
Meteorological journal and sea log of His Majesty's ship, Isabella. Wind direction south, wind force, light airs, temperature 53 degrees, barometric pressure 29.
Dennis Wheeler joins us from the University of Sunderland. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Guy.
Tell me about these logbooks. Where do they come from and what were they used for?
Well, the vast majority of logbooks we use are the logbooks of ships in the service of the Royal Navy. The Admiralty made it compulsory for all captains, masters and lieutenants, that's to say senior officers on board, to maintain a regular daily logbook of their activities in which they had to describe what was going on board, supplies of food, water taken in and so on and so forth. But they also were very careful to stipulate that officers had to record the weather.
So they're basically recording temperature and wind speed and barometer pressure and things like that every day.
Well, first of all, from 1680 until about, let's say, 1770, 1780, the first 100 years, we don't have any instruments on board. They were far too valuable and far too complex to put on board something as uncertain as a ship. And for the first 100 years, what we have is useful information on wind force, wind direction, and the general state of the weather. Now, just because it doesn't have numbers doesn't mean it isn't useful for us. In fact, it's extremely useful information. Mm-hmm. But we find that it's very valuably supplemented from about 1780 onwards by the increasing appearance of barometers, that's for measuring air pressure, and thermometers for measuring air and sometimes sea temperatures, which are regularly carried on board by officers of the Royal Navy and by some other ships as well.
And some of these logbooks are from relatively famous journeys, the HMS Beagle, the ship on which Darwin traveled, Captain Cook's boat, the Resolution.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, this particular project that we've just completed is one that is focused specifically on the logbooks of voyages of discovery. You mentioned Darwin already, and he was on board the Beagle for its 3 or 4 year circumnavigation of the globe. And we have Cook as well. These are all skilled scientists, so they supplemented the normal daily observational routine with much more detailed observations, sometimes taking thermometer readings every hour. And these are amazingly useful for us.
Professor Wheeler, what questions do you hope to answer by looking at this data?
What we need to do is to get a very firm understanding of the degree of natural variation, not only over land. We understand that fairly clearly now, but we do need to look at the oceans as well. They're so big and they're such an important part of the whole climatic system. And once we've got that clearer picture, what it means is that the people who are engaged in predictions for the future can take their models, the general circulation models, as they know, the GCMs. These models need to be calibrated, and we can only calibrate them against past conditions. Well, fairly obviously, the more data we have for the past, the more accurate our picture of the past, the better is the calibration on those models. So when you use them to look to the future, we can be just that bit more precise about how temperatures are likely to change over the next 20, 50, or maybe even 100 years.
From these logbooks, are we able to get a sense of how far the polar ice caps have receded and whether there was, you know, more sea ice at the time these journeys were taking place, you know, versus 50 years later or 100 years later or today?
That's right. It's a very good question. The answer is yes, we can. And this is where the non-instrumental data that I mentioned before is so useful, because these ships were careful to record their encounters with icebergs, pack ice and ice that would freeze them up for the winter, because many of them in the Arctic Oceans would be quite prepared to spend a winter up there and engaged usually in a search for the Northwest Passage, the quick route through to the North Pacific Ocean. So we are able to plot very carefully year by year where the ice advanced and how far it retreated. So the summer retreats, the winter advances are dated and spatially defined for us, and that's extremely useful data.
Now the idea is that these logbooks will all be digitized eventually, which will give everybody access to see them. What's it like to handle those old logbooks?
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, some of the older ones that we use from the less famous voyages, we're aware that when we open those pages, it's probably the first time they've been opened in the 200 years since they were written. Mm-hmm. And that's an absolutely extraordinary and very enriching experience.
Dennis Wheeler is a climate researcher at the University of Sunderland in Britain. Dennis Wheeler, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.